Hey, you guys, look at the movie that we're talking about today, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. That's actually one of my favorite movie titles ever. I don't know why. There's something about it that's
What's
very
the name of the director
evocative.
again?
Charles B. Pierce.
Charles B. Pierce. The most interesting thing about this movie is the director, Charles B. Pierce. He's the dude that also did the Boggy Creek movies.
Movies, yeah.
And he's a trip. He's an independent filmmaker from, where was he, Texarkana or
From
Tex from
Arkansas, yeah.
Arkansas? Okay. And he was trying to show those Hollywood boys that rednecks could make movies. Swamp people could make movies.
Which,
Which he can.
technically he did make
This
movies.
is the best movie he's made in terms of just
Yeah.
quality and the story. It is like a slasher. It is a slasher. But it's also a documentary at the same time, and it has elements of documentary in it. Which I liked it because it kept reminding you that this was something that actually did happen, even though certain ways that people got killed and the way it ended was not exactly the way it happened, but close, close. It's an entertaining movie.
They took some artistic license.
And the legendary Jimmy Klem is in it.
I had totally forgotten because I saw this movie a long time ago, and we've talked about this on various other matinee shows and stuff. But Jimmy Klem is the guy that was in Boggy Creek 2, and the legend continues. He might have been in the first Boggy Creek as well because he tended to use like all the same actors. And
Jimmy Klem is a hidden gem of this guy's flicks. He puts Klem in there, and Klem he doesn't phone this shit in. He's acting. It's funny though. He comes across as a guy that would probably be really amusing in real life.
Yeah, because I think he's just playing
It's
himself.
like he is playing
I
himself.
mean, most of the people in this, there's a couple of kind of bigger known actors in The Town That Dreaded Sundown, like Mary Wells, who played Dawn Wells rather, who played Marianne on Gilligan's Island, and Andrew Prine, who was in Grizzly, and he was in like a shit ton of movies and TV in the 70s, and he's in this as well playing one of the cops. But most of the other people in the movie are locals, like to Texarkana.
And the girl that played Marianne in this from Gilligan's Island, she's in it, and she looks just like she did in Gilligan's Island. She's cute as a bug. I don't know how old she is. Probably in her 30s, maybe in this movie,
Yeah.
but she looks young and cute, and it's good to see her in the movie. And she's one of the victims, but she survives.
Yeah,
And
she
she's
plays Katie Starks, I think, who was like the last victim who didn't die. She actually did survive.
She went through hell and she made it. So she's kind of like a hero in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
You
I mean,
kind of
in
root.
real life, because okay, so I guess if you don't know, The Town That Dreaded Sundown came out in 1976 and was based on the real life case of the Phantom Killer of Texarkana, otherwise known as the Moonlight Murders, which we did a show about a long time ago.
It's basically a case similar to Son of Sam
Or
or
Zodiac. It's almost
Zodiac.
like proto-Zodiac. It happened in 1946, like over
Well,
like a 10-week period in 1946.
I was comparing it to Son of Sam because he was getting people's in lovers' lanes for a while, but then he went into their houses eventually too. So he started to do a little bit of Dennis Rader type shit.
Yeah, well,
He
it
went
was
to
just
people's houses.
the last one that he did.
Within somebody's house,
Yeah, and he actually shot through the
And he
windows.
was graduating to something, and then he just disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to him. The movie ends with a big scene of the cops seeing him and chasing him down and having shooting at him through a tra through a train that went by, and then he slips away to give it kind of a dramatic ending. But that's not what happened in real life. In real life, he committed that crime and vanished. They never found him.
Yeah, and it's still unsolved. A lot of the cops that worked on the case, they had their suspicions of who the main suspect was, who was a dude named Ewell Swinney. But he was actually in prison for other things, car theft, forgery, that kind of crap. And a lot of the cops that were working on the case thought that it was probably him. He was kind of like the main or the prime suspect, but they never had enough information. And I think honestly the scene in The Town That Dreaded Sundown where they catch that guy named Eddie whatever and like they say something about car theft, I think that was supposed to represent him. Because like I said, okay, so
They'll
my
never know, though.
no, I don't it's too long ago because like I said it happened in 1946.
And I remember reading about that suspect that you were talking about. And he kind of did look like it could have been him, but it kind of matches up with other cases. G suspects like that appear in other well-documented cases, and sometimes it turns out that it wasn't that dude. He looked like it could have been him, but it wasn't him.
So, he was kind of like the only serious suspect they had, honestly. And from what I've known of, he was a criminal, but I don't really know if he was the Phantom Killer.
I have a strange suspicion, or sneaking suspicion, that it was somebody that they never suspected.
Maybe.
It was a true phantom, a guy who was living a secret fantasy life. And maybe they came close to catching him, or after that last one, he realized maybe he wasn't going to get his fix, that it wasn't as fun as he imagined it to be, or it wasn't as satisfying as he imagined it to be, so he just stopped doing it, which that has happened before.
Yeah.
Serial killers have just gone cold. They're like, they kind of lose their lust for it, and they just stop.
I do kind of like, and they sort of point this out in the movie as well, that for a time they were pretty sure that the Phantom Killer was not just some dude that had wandered in town. They thought that it was somebody local. They thought it was somebody around there.
Yeah.
Who was kind of, like you said, sort of living a double life. And actually, when this movie came out, it has like a tagline on the poster. And actually the dude that painted the poster, he got like a lot of work later. He did. Yeah. I think he even did those original Star Wars trilogy posters. Just saying, it's like the same artist. But there was a tagline on the poster that said something like, the dude might still be lurking around Texarkana. Yeah. And when the movie came out, like the dudes that were in charge of Texarkana were like, can we not have that on the poster? Because it's like we really don't like, the fact that people would still be like.
Yeah.
Think that they're still creeping around, but they did actually, they did succeed in getting it taken off some of the merchandising, but not all of it.
There's a chance that this case could have been something like the original Night Stalker, where it was a cop that was doing it all along. And that could have been,
that wouldn't shock.
Might have been in the damn police force that was handling the investigation. Cause that's kind of like an arsonist that joins the damn fire department.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So they can see fires and start fires and then go put the fire out. You know, you have dudes that are like that. They become cops because they want to kill people. And then they want to see the investigation, too. They want to be part of the investigation.
It's like a win-win.
So, and then all of a sudden he feels powerful because he's in the group of cops and he's seeing that he's fooling them all from the inside. So that would be like an added thing. So it may have been something like that. Who was the original Night Stalker? What was his real name?
D'Angelo.
D'Angelo. And I thought it was a cop back when we were covering that case, and what was it, a couple months later, it turned out they caught him, D'Angelo, and he was a cop.
Yeah.
And it just, so it might have been something, I have a suspicion it might have been one of the cops.
Yeah, could have been. Which is maybe why they never caught him.
Because of the kind of skills that he showed.
Although I will say that the way that they kind of portray the cops in this movie, not all of them, but we'll get to the one in a minute. But the way that they portray the cops in this movie, it's not surprising that they never caught him, but I know that they probably weren't like
that. I think if it was one of the cops, it wasn't one of the main ones, it was one of the fucking invisible cops on the periphery.
Yeah.
Who wasn't getting any attention. Kind of a, it was something like that.
Yeah.
And they never suspected him.
So, all right. So, as we said, Charles B. Pierce is from Texarkana, Arkansas, although I think he was living in Shreveport, Louisiana, around the time that this was made. So, he had made The Legend of Boggy Creek, which was about, how do you say that? Is it the Fouke monster or the Fouke monster?
F-O-U-K-E? Fouke
monster? Could be lots of different, I don't know, I'm not from Arkansas. But that's what the Boggy Creek movie was about. That came out in 1972, and he kind of got a lot of, traction out of that. So he decided he was going to make a movie about another local story, which was the Texarkana Moonlight Murders from the 1940s. Now, as I said, they have like an opening narration, which I guess, I mean, The Legend of Boggy Creek is also kind of like a docudrama, a documentary type thing.
Yeah.
And, with... That's people being interviewed and shit. Yeah. But the way that they do the narration is almost kind of, it's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre-y as well. So that was, I guess it was just kind of all in the zeitgeist.
Which that happened after, though.
Yeah. Texas. Yeah, that came out in 1974. That came out after Boggy Creek, but before this one.
I think what it was is it was a thing of convenience.
Yeah.
All right. First of all, doing some voiceover lends credence to the story because it's based in something that really happened. So you can do it in a docudrama style, which kind of adds some scariness to it. Because The audiences of the time were not as sophisticated as we are today. We know we grew up in those times. And the internet wasn't there, so they're seeing this case for the first time. It was hard to research stuff like this, so you could really scare them with kind of like the official voiceover, like the voice of authority. And if you noticed, it gave exposition, so you didn't have to shoot certain things, so you saved money.
Yeah.
That was another thing.
And I will say that it's clear that this movie is low budget,
yeah,
but it's competently shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's actually pretty entertaining. Actually, I will say that some of the scenes of the Phantom Killer attacking some of the people are actually really, really well done and actually really kind of creepy.
Kind of like something out of Friday the 13th Part 2.
Yeah, so they actually did that really, really well. And like I said, the whole bag head thing, like, you know, the killer with the bag over his head, because you were saying, oh, that's like Jason in Friday the 13th Part 2. Yeah. I said, yeah, but, you know, you could say that Friday the 13th Part 2 ripped off Town That Dreaded Sundown, but I was like, well, the actual Phantom Killer back in 1946 had a white bag over his head. He was described by the survivors.
I have a feeling that Friday the 13th Part 2 was a ripoff of this idea.
Of the Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah, because it's a very early slasher.
They saw this movie. You can see it in the choreography and the way they shot certain kills. And that bag on the head was a spooky element. They just omitted one eye.
Yeah.
Instead of having two eyes cut in the bag, they just left one.
Yeah.
And the way they would shoot at his face and you could see the eyes. It was a good idea. And Friday the 13th copying this movie, I think it was a good idea. They did the right thing because Friday the 13th got more exposure than this movie, I believe, in those days.
Yeah.
Everybody's seen it now. But this was a limited release back in those days. I had never even heard of this movie.
Well, they did a remake of it in 2014, which was, well, I don't even know if it was so much a remake. It was like a meta. It was fictionalized, but it existed in the universe where the murders had happened and the movie had happened. And then it was almost like about a copycat killer.
Yeah. But I was talking about us growing up in the 80s.
Yeah.
I had never heard of this movie. We never saw it alongside Friday the 13th. This movie was forgotten by us when we were kids.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was kind of out of circulation by the time we were old enough to see it. And by the time cable came around. I'm sure it reemerged on VHS.
Yeah, I remember seeing the cover. I don't remember if I saw it back then, though. No, I think I saw it later, like maybe in the 90s.
The closest thing I ever saw anything like this back in the early 80s was Friday the 13th Part 2.
Yeah.
And I would have liked this one, too.
Or you know what? I might have seen this on TV, because it did kind of make the rounds of like TBS or some channels like that. Like, I think back in the mid-80s, maybe, I want to say.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe even earlier than that. Yeah, so it might have kind of, because I do remember seeing bits of it, like, off and on. So let's kind of talk about, if you're familiar with the case of the Phantom Killer, which, like I said, we covered on another show, it's basically happened in the 1940s in Texarkana, and it was a killer that targeted couples in lovers' lanes. Like I said, much like, it was like a proto-Zodiac, kind of. And this film follows the events fairly accurately. The timeline's kind of messed up. I think they kind of start, because like I said, it's very documentary-like. So they're like, you know, it's March 3rd, like 1946 or whatever. Whereas actually the first attack took place in late February of 1946. Those two victims actually did survive. And one thing that I thought was really weird, they added a few things. Like, they added that some of the victims, like the first girl that was attacked, they said she wasn't raped, but in real life, she was actually sexually assaulted with a pistol. The guy like stuck a pistol up her vagina. In the movie, but they didn't really mention that in the movie, but in the movie, they said she was covered with bite marks, and I'm pretty sure that that's not accurate. So I don't know why they like changed shit out. And also this first scene.
Because they couldn't talk about the pistol.
Maybe not. So they had to come up with something else. And then the fact too that the first attack, the guy that survived, the guy gets pulled out the window, the car window, and that didn't happen.
Yeah, and that looked like something out of Friday the 13th. Man, this is like Friday the 13th. Seeing that scene.
Well, and particularly.
That's like something Jason would have done. Yeah. He's a big dude.
Yeah.
And he's kind of in coveralls, wasn't he? With a bag on his head.
Yeah.
Or was it just jeans and a flannel shirt?
It was just jeans and like a kind of shirt.
Yeah, but it was similar.
Yeah, yeah.
Similar image of Jason from Friday the 13th Part 2 before they put the hockey mask on him.
Yeah.
I liked it. I liked it. I thought it was cool.
Actually, the guy that played the Phantom in this, his name was Bud Davis, and he was actually a stuntman, and he was a stunt coordinator on, like, some big movies later. He did, like, Inglourious Basterds with Quentin Tarantino. He did Castaway, Forrest Gump. So he did a bunch of, like, he went on to, like, kind of a big career, which was
ended up, in retrospect, being a cult classic. It wasn't at the time, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the only thing, okay, now here's what I'm going to get into. Well, you know, going back to what we said about some of the kills seeming like Friday the 13th kills, and like I said, it's very strange. They changed everyone's name, and some of the people, like the cop that gets brought in that they call Lone Wolf, there actually was a Texas Ranger whose nickname was Lone Wolf that they brought in on the case, but his name was otherwise different. He had a different last name, so he was kind of an amalgamation. So some of the cops are amalgamations of a couple of people. So they did kind of try to get, and like I said, the victims are pretty accurate. They changed all their names, just, I guess, so they wouldn't get in trouble. Although that didn't end up helping them in the end, because you have to think, when this movie came out, it was only 30 years after the crimes had happened, and the victims were young. They were usually like teenagers or in their 20s. So a lot of the relatives of the victims were still alive, and a couple of them were not super happy about the way that the movie portrayed them. I think one of the victims' brothers actually sued Charles B. Pierce for various things because of, like, the way that his sister was portrayed in the movie, even though her name was different. But I don't think he won. I think he was looking for, like, $1.5 million or something like that. But let's talk about the scene with the trombone, because I feel like you can't talk about The Town That Dreaded Sundown without talking about the trombone kill, which, like I said, is very, very much like some shit that Jason would do.
Yeah, kind of. I guess so, later on.
Yeah, later Friday the 13th.
Yeah, like 5,
movie.
6,
it,
7,
actually,
8.
It almost seems almost like a Freddy move.
Yeah, it does.
A little bit.
It seems like a Freddy move. I kind of thought the movie suffered because of this scene. I didn't think it was a credible.
Well, Charles B. Pierce got a lot of flack for it at the time because,
I thought it was too goofy.
Yeah, you will probably not be surprised to know that that was not how that victim was murdered. She actually didn't even play the trombone. She played a saxophone. And they did find, like, her saxophone later, because she had been coming from a band performance at a VFW, not a prom, like in the movie. But they didn't find her saxophone in its case until about 6 months later. Like, it was in a field, like, near where she'd been killed. But she was not stabbed with a trombone.
Yeah.
And they did ask Charles B. Pierce, it's like, why, what possessed you to, like, put that in the movie? Because it's kind of goofy, and it's really not respectful toward, like, the real girl that was actually killed.
That's why they changed all the names.
But it's like I said, he still kind of got in trouble, but he didn't get, he got sued, but he still won because he, I don't know. It's like he made a big deal about saying this is a true story, but then he changed, like, all these really bizarre details.
I can kind of understand why, though.
Yeah. He's
trying to be respectful to the families by not bringing up the person's name and saying, this is what happened to your kid. That's
yeah.
He's trying to avoid that, and he's trying to avoid lawsuits. So he's fictionalizing the murders in there, and he's changing the names to protect the innocent. Was old fucking phrase they used to use.
That was on Dragnet.
Changing the names to protect the innocent.
Yeah,
that's what they're doing.
It just was. I feel like that's kind of the most infamous scene.
Yeah.
Even though, like I said, it's not accurate. But some of this shit, like I said, the last murder, which was Virgil and Katie Starks, were their real names. That wasn't what their names were in the movie. But that was almost entirely accurate, at least from what I remember. The case where, the dude, like, shot the husband through the window, like, and just killed him. He was sitting in his chair and then shot the wife. She ran to call the police and it shot her in the face. And, like, knocked all her teeth out, and then she, like, ran, but she got away.
Yeah. The woman that they showed in the movie getting killed by a trombone, in reality, I think she got killed by, didn't he beat her to death with a baseball bat?
Or I can't remember. She might have gotten stabbed, or because he, the Phantom Killer used different methods. Yeah. He shot a lot of the victims. Some of the victims he beat, with tire irons, bats, blunt objects, things like that. I think a couple of them he stabbed. Some of them it was like multiple, but he did not kill anybody with a knife on the end of a trombone. So no. I'm just saying that's probably like the most infamous scene. Now, so let's talk about as fairly accurate to real life as this movie is. Other than, like I said, there's the whole chase at the end where the two cops are like shooting at the Phantom Killer because he's just in the middle of the day hanging out in the, you know, woods or whatever, like with the mask on, which I thought was very funny. So but they're like shooting at him under the train and stuff. Yeah, that didn't happen. The cops never saw him. The only people that saw him, as far as I know, were the victims that lived. They're the ones that said with the white bag over the head and everything. So even though it tried to do that, and I feel like it almost was doing like a serious, like a docudrama kind of feel to it, which was good. You know, like I said, it was almost kind of like a police procedural, which, you know, seemed respectful. But then for whatever inexplicable reason, Charles B. Pierce decided he was going to put himself in the movie as a completely fictional character who was like a patrolman, right? I can't even remember what his character's name was, all that other than Sparkplug. That was his nickname. And he puts himself in there as essentially a low-level cop who's a complete and utter moron. And he's like the comic relief. And it just seemed like so tonally strange and unnecessary because it seemed like he was trying to make a fairly, you know, respectful movie about the crimes. And then he inserts himself in there and like this goofy, like he drives like an idiot. Yeah. There's one like 3 minute long scene where he gets in the car, he's driving, you know, lone wolf around and he's like, oh, I forgot the keys. Doo doo doo. And then there's like this goofy ass music. And then he goes, walks all the way back into the police station and all the way like looks for the keys. It takes forever. And
he's trying to be in his own movie as much as possible.
Well, he did that in Boggy Creek too. Yeah. And like I said, if you see Boggy Creek 2 and The Legend Continues, that's he wrote himself as like the main character in that one.
That's really when he becomes interesting. Those movies and those shorts.
At least that movie was about like a Bigfoot monster. Yeah. So it wasn't about like real people that got murdered.
And it was kind of the same kind of tone where it's kind of a pseudo documentary, you know, trying to get you to suspend your disbelief and think that, well, back in those days, I remember, you know, I was a kid. Bigfoot and Bigfoot type creatures were a very strong possibility. The population wasn't as dense back then. We didn't have satellites that could track down individual body signatures of people in game. There might have been a possibility that there was something like a Bigfoot. Not in that area, though. Not in the Boggy Creek area. Roads are running everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
You know, all you got to do is walk long enough in any one direction, you're going to hit a road. Like, yeah. Within 20, 30 miles. So yeah. It's just not open wilderness. So if anything like that were to exist, it'd be up in Washington State or up in Canada and places where people have never set foot. But
I mean, yeah. But okay. So like I said, I don't mind, even though the comic relief in the Boggy Creek movies is not funny in the way that they intended it, maybe. I just feel like the choice for him to just insert himself as like the lone comic relief character in a serious, otherwise serious movie about a series of real murders that happened is just baffling to me. And the fact that he, you know, that, like I said, there's that whole interminable scene of him like losing the car keys. There's like, just that one scene where, which actually did happen in real life, where they were trying to bait the killer by having, you know, undercover cops like out in Lover's Lanes and stuff. So of course they have like this wacky scene in the town that dreaded sundown where some of the cops like dress up as women and, you know, they go out and sit in the car. So there's like this bizarre scene where Charles B. Pierce in drag is sitting in a car with Jimmy Clem. And they're just like talking and Jimmy Clem is like laughing and then he's like squeezing his tit and all that kind of shit. It's just like the most Arkansas thing.
I totally understand it. He's the reason why he wrote himself in there doing all that crazy shit is he's making a very kind of novice mistake, but he's making this mistake because of the times in which he is making this movie, the era in which he is making this movie. This is a subject matter that is basically taboo. In the time that this came out, this would have been a cutting-edge slasher movie, disturbing, kind of immoral to the average older person of the time. Like a person in their 40s and their 50s would not accept this movie. They just wouldn't. They wouldn't see this shit. They'd go, oh, that's terrible. This is like making a snuff film. So what he's doing, he's inserting himself as a clown to try to bring comedic relief and levity to the movie.
Yeah.
Trying to tell the audience of his era that this movie is not to be taken seriously. But on the other hand, he's telling you to take it real fucking serious.
Yeah.
Seriously with the over the overdubs. You know, with the voiceovers.
Yeah.
And you know, like a documentary. So he's trying to offset that.
I get that with
all that clown. Now, was that a good artistic decision? No.
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 It was definitely not.
Pick one or the other. He's just trying to hedge his bets. Is what he's trying to do.
Yeah, I think that he's just trying to
give plausible deniability to the movie.
Yeah. I mean, he wanted to be in his own movie, but he's like, well, I don't want to look like arrogant, so I'm going to put myself in there as an idiot. That's one thing. And then the second thing, like you said, it's like, oh, this is such horrible subject matter. Because as I said, when this came out, a lot of locals were in it. You know, this was still in living memory. Like a lot of people, all their relatives were still alive and
they'd
shit
have been
like
watching
that.
It.
and he knew that they were going to be watching it. Yeah. So, you know, I can see why. I just think it was like...
bad artistic decision.
It was just not the way to go. And I know that in the early 70s, too, because I feel like didn't, some other movies that came out in the 70s that were, like, otherwise... I'm thinking maybe of, like, Last House on the Left or something like that, where it had these really strange, like, oh, Keystone Cop kind of like, oh, we're going to put some comedic relief in here because otherwise... lessen the tension. And I'm going to say, I mean, horror and comedy, they go well together, but you need a real deft hand to pull that off.
And you end up with Evil Dead or Bubba Hotep.
Yeah. It's like, and those are successful, or Shaun of the Dead or something like that. But I feel like a lot of times when it gets attempted, it falls flat on its face.
He just
grafted it
in there.
Yeah.
Just grafted some comedy onto a horror movie. He should have left all that out. It would have been a much darker movie, but it would have had like a very pretty even tone throughout it.
Yeah, because it was very serious otherwise. And as I said, the shots, I mean, the scenes, the sequences where the murders took place were actually really, really well done. I thought they were really effective.
Without the comedic relief, it probably would have been taken a little more seriously on an artistic level, and the movie probably would have gotten a little more notoriety, I think.
It could be.
It would have gone down as kind of like the first fucking Friday the 13th type movie. That's what I think it would. Or an early version of an American one, you know, something like that.
Probably.
Like Halloween, maybe.
I mean, or you could argue, though, that the fact that the character, that the, comic relief in it was so egregious, and add that to, like, the trombone kill.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what made people remember it. Like, you know,
maybe
counterintuitively. I'm not really sure.
The trombone idea just wasn't a good idea.
Well, like I said, it's not only disrespectful to the victim, but it was also just dumb. Like, why?
He was trying to be edgy. We're going to take this, you know, this killer has fun with his victims, and we're going to take this, you know, it's going to, and it was just a bad idea. If you're going to have, he could have come up with something better than that.
Yeah, because a trombone is an inherently goofy instrument.
Yeah. And he was being kind of goofy with it.
Yeah, because he was like, oh, gonna get you. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, undercut the menace a little bit.
Yeah.
I have to say, I had forgotten about this as well, but that the girl that gets killed with the trombone, she was in Boggy Creek 2 as well.
Okay.
I don't know if she was in the first one. She was one of the two hot girls.
Okay.
That I didn't recognize her at first because, like I said, this is a period piece. It's set in 1946, even though it was made in the 70s. And I didn't, with her 40s hair and makeup, I didn't recognize her, but as soon as I heard her voice, I was like, oh, that's that chick from Boggy Creek 2. Because I've seen Boggy Creek 2 because it was on Mystery Science Theater. I've seen it about a million times. But so this movie, as I said, it's sort of like, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say it's like a lost classic or anything like that. I don't know if I'd go as far as to say it was a classic, but it did a lot of things that were, if maybe it wasn't the first time to do them, but it was like very unusual at the time. I feel like it had a lot of slasher tropes before that was really a thing. I know Black Christmas had come out 2 years before, so it wasn't completely unprecedented. And, Texas Chainsaw Massacre had come out 2 years before, too. But it was one of the first ones to do this sort of serious docudrama kind of thing. And it was sort of one of the ones, I know Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, said it was based on a real story. It was based on Ed Gein, but it was very, very loosely based.
Very loose.
Very, very loosely based. I mean, to the point where it's like not
it's
even.
It's not really, no.
You know, and Psycho was sort of based on Ed Gein. Again, very, very loosely. But I think this was kind of one of the first films, if not the first film, that was actually tried to be accurate to an actual set of murders.
Yeah.
You know, and tried to take it seriously, you know, notwithstanding the ridiculous comic relief that they really shouldn't have put in there. Although I laughed my ass off at that scene of Charles B. Pierce and Jimmy Clem in the car.
Yeah.
And him like squeezing his titty.
Yeah.
And you could tell that like Jimmy Clem was like just laughing and they should have done it.
Ad-libbed.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought it was ad-lib because he was just, like, cracking up and they weren't even, like, making an attempt to, like, do another take or anything.
Yeah, Jimmy Clem is...
just made me laugh.
Jimmy Clem, from what I can see, he was a natural clown. He was funny.
Oh, yeah,
that's probably why he was in the movie.
And he had, like, a big, like, H.H. Holmes mustache in this movie.
And I don't know anything about his background. He might have been a local legend for being a clown. That's probably what it was.
You know what? It wouldn't surprise me. Because like I said, he was in Boggy Creek too as well, playing Crenshaw.
Yeah.
Like he was that mountain man.
That's his greatest role. That was his greatest role. I look at this movie as a very competent early slasher. Especially American style slasher. I mean, the Italians were already on this by this time. But as far as the American style, and it's Southern, which is very good for being a Southern product. Very good.
Yeah.
This is not something from Hollywood, and it was better than a lot of Hollywood B movies.
Yeah, I mean, it's low budget, but it's actually shot pretty well.
Pretty good,
I thought.
And they took it seriously. But I think some of the local politics about offending families and trying to bring some levity to it, I think artistically that was not a good decision by today's standards. Back then, it might have been something that he had to do by necessity because of the local politics with the families and stuff.
Yeah.
He's trying to settle everybody down. And, hey, don't take it so seriously. We're changing the name to protect the innocent. Yeah, yeah. It was like that, I think. Enjoyable movie to watch.
It is.
Enjoyable.
And they actually shot it in Texarkana, where the actual murders happened.
Yeah.
And Texarkana doesn't actually look that different than it looked when this movie was shot. Yeah. Do you know, I think still to this day, they show this movie every Halloween in that park in Texarkana.
Had I seen this in the early 80s alongside Halloween alongside Friday the 13th 1 and 2, I would have put it right there with them. Although Friday the 13th had a lot more of a sexual element. It had real cute girls in it getting killed. And there was
gorier.
A little bit gorier. But it would have been totally kind of the same. Just as watchable.
Similar.
I would have been spooked by it and creeped out by it.
And like I said, that one scene where, you know, where he shoots that one guy and like that other chick is like getting stabbed or whatever, that was like actually a legit creepy scene. Yeah. I thought it was like pretty horrific.
Had it not had the comedy in it, this director probably could have gone on to do a long series similar to Friday the 13th, kind of in the way that the guy who did Phantasm.
Don Coscarelli.
Yeah. It might have been something similar to that. But I think because of the flaws of the film, I think the concept didn't have staying power. In other words, it was also about one case.
So
you couldn't really continue it. Which maybe had he not made it about a case, he could have made a continuing franchise. But had he done that, it wouldn't have been about the location he lived in.
Yeah, and I mean,
He's trying to do stories that are local.
That are local, which is cool.
Yeah, actually a good concept.
He's trying
to bring Southern culture to the mainstream as much as he can, and trying to use local legends. And that was his strategy.
Yeah.
Which I guess it worked. I mean, he made fucking a total of four movies. Three of them were Bigfoot movies.
He made some other movies too, but I think those are like kind of his best known ones.
Yes. Yeah. One of the Bigfoot movies is lost. It was scrapped and then redone it again.
Yeah. I mean, it might be out there somewhere, but I've actually never seen it. I've only seen the first one, which came out in 1972, and then the third one, which is actually called Boggy Creek. I could probably dig it up, yeah. But like I said, he made some other ones too, but. And I think he worked on other movies, too. I think, I could be wrong. I think he was like a set decorator on Outlaw Josie Wales.
Oh, okay. Is he still living?
No, he died in 2010. Okay. I think. So he's been dead a while.
All right.
But, yeah, had he not, like, tried to be a goofball in some of his movies...
I think he'd had a little more staying power.
Maybe, yeah, because I just feel like that was kind of... Like I said, it's fine in the Boggy Creek movies because it's about a fucking, you know, Sasquatch monster.
Yeah.
But if you're going to talk about, like, real people that got killed, then...
Had he taken the humor out of this, it probably would have been a movie that Fangoria would have talked about and, you know, maybe upped the gore a little bit more.
Yeah.
It probably would have been something that... the slasher scene would have really remembered. Although they did talk about it off and on, if I remember. I remember talking about it.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it all the time.
It wasn't one of the fucking main ones back in the early 80s that came up a lot.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, so that's Town That Dreaded Sundown from 1976. Like I said, they did a remake in 2004. Well, sort of a remake, which actually wasn't too bad. I saw it a while back. I don't remember that much about it, but that's a completely fictional story. It's not anything about the... Moonlight Murders, but you know, if you want to check that out, you can. We actually watched this for free on YouTube, so if it's still there, then you can go check it out as well. I think it might also be on Amazon Prime, depending on where you are. But yeah, that'll do it for this movie retrospective, and we will see you guys on the next one. Bye.